طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning everyone and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was hosted for many years by Sharif Fahm, and is continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues and friends. Good morning. This is your host, John Roberts, and this morning on This Week in Palestine, we will be focusing on what Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, and to what Israelis refer to as their independence, the creation of the State of Israel. As we know, to create the State of Israel in 1948, Jewish military forces drove 750,000 indigenous Palestinians out of over 350 of their towns and villages into exile in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, where most of their progeny live to this day. At the time of this ethnic cleansing, Jews owned only 6% of the land and constituted only 30% of the population, but they had the military might to take most of the land and drive the majority of its Palestinian inhabitants into exile. Since they were the minority in the land, the Jews were intent on creating a state where they would be the majority. They did so through ethnic cleansing. Part of the glue that sustains Palestinian culture is their continuing relationship to the towns and villages from which they were driven in 1947 and 1948. It is their tie to this land that they continue to contend is rightfully theirs. When we visited several refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon and spoke with the refugees there, one of our sharpest memories is the response we got when we asked children where they were from. Even to this day, the reply was to say the name of the village from which their grandparents or even great-grandparents were driven. It is a major part of their identity and why the right to return, guaranteed by international law and the United Nations resolutions, remains a cornerstone to any acceptable peace agreement with Israel. Their land was stolen, and return or restitution and reparations cannot be taken off the table. The Nakba is, of course, well documented in such books as Israeli historian Ilan Pape's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. But it is not until you hear the personal stories of the survivors of the ethnic cleansing and their families that the magnitude of this tragedy hits home. It is when you hear Palestinians talk about their land that you come to understand that the Palestinians are not going away. And all the sophisticated schemes and plans by Israel to transfer Palestinians out of historic Palestine, and believe me, there are many, will come to naught. The Palestinian population is increasing. Israel does have a demographic problem. It continues to steal Palestinian land to build Jewish settlements, but the indigenous people remain. Being there is their resistance. Protecting their culture is their resistance. This morning we will hear the story of one family which was driven out of their home and off their land. It is a story of the Abusroor family, which was forced to leave their home in what is now Israel and were sent into what has become the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Abdul Fattah Abusroor, fondly known as Abed, is the founder and director of the Al Rawad Theater Training and Cultural Society in the Ida refugee camp. He tells his family's story. Abed has been a frequent visitor to the Cambridge-Boston area ever since the Cambridge-Bethlehem People-to-People Project brought the Al Rawad Theater Troupe to the United States in the summer of 2009 to tour the Northeast. Al Rawad gave theatrical presentations in the Central Square Theater in Cambridge, the Bread and Puppet Theater in Vermont, the Payamet Theater in Truro, as well as the Atlantic Theater in New York City, among other venues. Abed told his family's Nakba story at a fundraiser for Al Rawad, which was held in Cambridge. He has become a friend of many of us who are committed to supporting his work with Al Rawad. He characterizes the work of Al Rawad as involving families in speaking truth to power through theater and dance in what he calls the beautiful resistance, a nonviolent resistance that emphasizes the power of Palestinian culture to stand against Israel's brutal occupation. Here, then, is Abud Abu Sroor telling his family's Nakba story.
Father comes from a village called Beit Natif, which is about 17 kilometers to the southwest of Jerusalem. My mother comes from a village called Zakaria, which is a nearby village also, and these are two among 534 villages which were completely destroyed and mostly erased from the map after the 1948. And when this happened, in fact, it happened on the 20th of October, 1948, when people start leaving the village after attack of Zionist groups. And the family stayed like in the fields for about 2 months in nearby Surif and Beit Umar village, which is like in the neighborhood between Bethlehem and Hebron. And they tried to sneak back again, but at each time there was Zionist patrols which were shooting. If people were trapped, they were killed or deported again. So after 2 months, they moved and rented a room in Beit Sahur. Beit Sahur is one of the cities in Bethlehem, governorate at the east of Bethlehem. And so they stayed almost a year there. The UN at that time, of course, created UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. And these people started renting lands for 99 years. So then they started distributing tents and calling upon refugees to come and register their names and so on. And so my uncle, I guess, registered all the family and moved to Ida refugee camp. Of course, part of the family was dispersed and moved to Jordan, some moved to Syria, some moved to Lebanon, some moved towards Gaza, some moved to the north towards Jenin, and some remained around in Bethlehem and then in Ida refugee camp. So at that time, 1949-1950, my family was like 70% of the population of Ida refugee camp, which was at that time around 800 people over a space of 5 acres, in fact. Historically, I mean, you are familiar probably with the Resolution 181 partition or recommendation of partition of Palestine in two states, one Jewish and one Palestinian, Arab, over 54% for Jews and the rest for the indigenous people. And that includes indigenous people, Palestinians, who are Muslim and Christian and Jews also. Some of the Jewish Palestinian population left the country, in fact, in 1948 as well, in protest that how can Jews do this to other people somehow? And some remain, like the Samaritans in Nablus, as Palestinian Jews, and who until today are Palestinian Jews speaking Arabic, having their shops in the Palestinian city of Nablus among the Christian and Muslim Palestinians, and have their representation in the Palestinian parliament. And of course, at that time, the UN gave 54% to Jewish population who owned like 6% of the land. And they composed around 30% of the population. So at that time, of course, Palestinians did not accept this division or partition. And the British got lost and they left the country, leaving these people fighting each other. And so there was a period like 5 months before the start of 1948 war, where these people were continued like left alone to fight with each other. And of course Israel won this war and they occupied 78% of the land instead of the 54%. And of course they didn't go back to the partition plan of 54%. And so it became annexed immediately, and now it's what we call the borders of 1967, in fact, which was the result of the war of 48, in fact. That created more refugees, of course, after 1967 war. And all the West Bank, Gaza, Sinai, Golan Heights were also occupied. And this little country won the war over six Arab countries. And people have been under Israeli occupation since that time. I was born in 1963, August 12, 1963. And I remember the images of 1967 war. And we had a cave behind our house in Aida refugee camp. And people from all over the camp came and hid in this cave. And I could remember these men aligning on the side of this cave, and we as children were like put inside somehow, hidden. And then I remember the first curfew in the camp about 1968. And I was playing with my older brother, and I guess the football just went to the street, and so we tried to like open the door and get it, and there was this probably 60 years old Iraqi Jewish soldier who was just guarding this place. My parents were married, in 1930s probably, and in 1940s. My eldest brother was born in 1945. My second brother, who is still alive, in 1947. So my eldest two brothers who are still alive were born in Beit Natif before the Nakba. The third one, who is still alive, in 56, and me, the last one, in 63. But my mother gave birth to 14. Four girls and six boys perished between 47, 48, and 1963. Some were few days old, some few months, some few years. And I guess I never knew these children, but apparently some of the girls lived 7, 8 years old. And being about 7 years under the tents, a lot of them really died of cold and malnutrition. Mm-hmm. After 7 years under the tents, these were big tents, like almost all this house, and so three or four families were divided to live in each corner under these same tents. And they recall that during winter times or even snow times, these, with the wind blowing them up, and one of my sisters, as my mother said, was, when it happened, like her bed just flipped and upside down, and where they were busy to collect, she was already suffocated and died. So it was very hard times. They used to go and with some containers to have water from like Silwan now, East Jerusalem, or back to nearby Beit Umar and so on, or Battir, water source. They used to collect the sick grass or wood to make fire, of course, to cook on fire at that time. And UNRWA started registering these refugees, and almost all Christian refugees did not register as refugees, or some registered as refugees but did not come and live in the refugee camps. Most of the rich Muslim families also did not come to install themselves in refugee camps. They were too proud not to have this humiliation of waiting in line and wait to receive charity and the humanitarian aid. So I guess people like my family, who own like more than 60% of the village properties, and my father, who was a merchant, they used to sell the cereals that they used to cultivate in their lands, and they have sheep, cows, they used to sell clothes and tissue and everything. Came like lost everything almost in a couple of nights. So it was hard for them, and I could remember my father still, until almost he passed away in 2006, still haunted by this idea that the Israelis will continue this and push us again and again. In 1956, UNRWA started building what they call shelters, which were small rooms of 9 square meters each. The thickness of the wall was about 3 inches. The thickness of the wall, of the roof was 4 inches. So this was like temporary shelters, as they say. It was one room for families with 6 members or less, or 2 rooms for bigger families. And so a lot of families were there staying. And I remember in the camp, we had like 4 public toilets, restrooms, or WCs, double units. And people used to go there to do their thing. And then there was like 4 corners of water distribution. So people have their containers, they go fill it and come back. And we had like these big barrels. We put asphalt inside so that it does not rust. And then we put the water so that we can use it for drinking, cooking, washing, and so on. In the 70s, most of these shelters start to crack down because they were not meant to last. And they were temporary, waiting for UN Resolution 194, requesting from Israel to facilitate the return of refugees to their own lands, be respected. But of course, Israel never respected that, and more than 80 of these UN resolutions. So people, like, they could not just wait and live in this misery. So they started, if they don't have enough money, just agglutinate one room next to the other, and then dig in the ground to make a hole and build the WC near the house. And those who have financial means destroy it completely and build the new houses. So actually, bit, little by little, the space in the camp shrinked little by little. And no more playgrounds or green spaces, especially after the building of this illegal wall of separation in 2002 as barbed wires, and in 2005 as these blocks of cement, which go from 6 meters to 12 meters high. I remember when I was a child, we used to make our sketches, our plays, and go in the fields, in fact, around the camp. There was the land in Tiras, so it was like natural theater space. And We used to make our shows there, and we used to create our soccer football playgrounds among the fields of olive trees, and there was big holes in the ground, so after rainy days like this, they were filled with water, and these were our open door swimming pools. And you can imagine how my mother was very happy to see me all muddy and so on. But we were, despite this occupation, we felt free somehow to move around. And people could go and arrive to Tel Aviv, to the north, over the borders to Lebanon or Syria. And sometimes when we were in school trips to the sea, to the Mediterranean, in Yaffa or whatever, you could see the guards just pushing us aside so that we don't mix with the Jewish population. But we could go. We could go wherever we wanted. We could reach wherever we wanted. And Israelis were coming to do their markets, to do the Palestinian markets, to buy goods from Bethlehem market in the city, in the center of Bethlehem, and so on. People used to talk. People used to speak and to host each other and to invite each other. So even despite that occupation, it wasn't between people. It was not, I look at you as Jewish enemy, and so on. It was looking at people who know each other, who meet with each other. And the enemy was the Israeli soldiers, those who are dressed as Israeli and soldiers and having the guns and so on. But, of course, things have changed, and little by little, we have like seen where this politics leads, in fact. Encouraging people to come work in Israeli colonies, building colonies, well-paid money, leave the land, agricultural land, leave the villages, cities, and come to the city and work in Israeli colonies and so on. So that little by little people have a high level. In fact, when I returned from France after getting my PhD, I was earning 1,000 shekels, which was equivalent to $250 per month. In the first 3 months of trial for work in the pharmaceutical company. And some of my colleagues, cousins who were did not finish the 90th grade, in fact, were earning like 6,000 shekels or 7,000 shekels at that time. And they were looking at me, you did your PhD and you come and blah, 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 and we just have 20 like you working under our command. And these same people, after the second intifada, were begging for money because they could not have a work or even a permit to go to the other side. So the end of it was that create like a system of dependence and conditioning people to get used to this luxury and then control people somehow. And so I guess growing in this refugee camp and see the space shrinking and getting the fortunate luck to be able to get a scholarship to continue my bachelor degree in Bethlehem University and starting learning French and then chosen as one of the 3 students to get a scholarship to continue to go to learn French in France in 1984. And then the two other guys have their permits, and I was denied my permit. Second time, third time, fourth time, fifth time, sixth time, refusal, refusal, refusal. Why? They asked, they invited me for an interrogation. And the Israeli interrogator said to me, well, we have a big file on you. And he showed me a file like this. I was never imprisoned and so on. But of course, my family has a history of resistance somehow. My brother was exiled in 1972 and exiled based on just an accusation without being judged or sent to the court, imprisoned 6 months and then just kicked away to Jordan. And he was never allowed to come back even for the funerals of my parents. And until now, he is denied also this entry. So I say to this, okay, if I am such a danger for your state, you should put me in prison. And he looked at me and said, because you care about the security of my state? I said, of course, if it concerns my own security, then yes. So he kicked me out and said, get out. You will see friends on TV. And I said, that's fine. Okay. So I don't give up, and I request a seventh time the permission, and I never got back there. Yeah. And later on, some people told me that they heard my name called. So what happened, in fact, at these times, in the 80s or 70s even, there was the military administration. So whatever we needed was needed a permit from the Israeli military administration. If you need a driving license, you should give this good behavior certificate from the Israeli military service. If you need a permit of building, if you need a permit to leave the country, if you need a permit to have a job in any institution, it's controlled by this good conduct or good behavior certificate or permit from the Israeli administrative military administration. And so the, of course, people requested the permits and they waited. And they tell them, come after a week, come after a month, come after whenever. So people keep going, and then they start calling the name of those who have permits. So they heard my name. So I went back, and there was the permit. Because the permit came like 9 months after the end of my scholarship. And of course, at that time, I was very depressed, in fact, and I didn't do any good in the semester after that. But when I got it, in fact, I called the French consulate and the French teachers and said, well, now I got it, so what we can do? Said, well, in fact, this year it was supposed 3 girls to be going, but we will send 2 girls and we'll keep your place. So I guess that was a relief, and I worked hard the last semester. And when I look at it, in fact, it was fortunately for me that they didn't give me the permit somehow. It's not to give any excuses for them. But, I mean, if I got the permit at that time, then I would go for a month or 3 months, and then I will get back to continue my last year at the university. But that way, also, I said, well, I can ask for a scholarship to continue my studies in France, which I did, in fact. And so I traveled for the first time of my life to France. And at that time, we used to travel with an Israeli travel document, which states our nationality as Jordanians. And until today, this same travel document exists for Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, who are considered as Jordanian temporary residents. So if they, like my case, my wife is from East Jerusalem, if she comes and lives in Bethlehem, officially she will lose her status as Jerusalemite, and her ID card would be confiscated. Even if she comes to the United States and marries with an American and gets an American passport and lives in the United States, she will also be deprived from this status. So I went to do my residency card, and they gave me a nationality, Jordanian refugee under Israeli mandate. And I looked and said, listen, I am not a Jordanian who fled the dictatorship of Jordan to be in the beautiful democracy of Israel. I am a Palestinian refugee under Israeli occupation, if you want to put such terminology. So after a big debate, they called me, okay, monsieur, come back tomorrow. I come back the next day, and they gave me this residency card with nationality to be determined. And I guess it's this irony of thing that you hear on the media, Palestinian terrorist, then we become Palestinian, flesh and the blood. But as human beings, we are denied this humanity.
Yeah.
And that makes me remember also the first time I came to the United States, in fact, in 2004. And I have at that time a Palestinian passport, travel document. And after 6 hours of waiting at JFK, I go to this immigration officer, name Abdel Fattah Abu Sroor, date of birth, August 12, 1963, place of birth, Bethlehem, country of birth, Palestine. Oh, we don't have that on the computers here, so where is it?
Where is it?
Well, Bethlehem, Palestine, Palestinian passport. Sorry, sir, we don't have that on the computers, so where is it? Well, in 1963, it was under Jordanian control. Oh, Jordan, yes. So here is Jordan. Father, Abdel Karim Abu Sroor, date of birth, 1910. I don't know the date, a day or month. They don't have that. Country of birth, city of birth, Beit Natif. Country of birth, Palestine. Oh, sorry, sir, I told you we don't have that on the computer, so where is it now? Well, Beit Natif in 1910 was in Palestine. It was the Ottoman Empire at that time. So where is it now? Well, it was occupied and destroyed by Israel in 1948. So is it in Israel now? It was occupied and destroyed by Israel. Okay, Israel. And the computer does not explode. He created Israel in 1910. And that's the irony of it sometimes, that, I mean, there is no logic on anything, and even some Jewish friends who have their birth certificates as Palestine, country of birth, and they have in the American passport, in fact, written Palestine at the time, and when they go to visit Israel, they were given hard time. And until finally, apparently, I met one of them in New York a couple of years ago. He just had enough and changed it to something like the city where he was born, and between brackets they put Israel or something like that. So they erase, too simply, a country like this, or identity like this. Well, I guess continuing to grow in a refugee camp and continuing to see my parents somehow keep these old rusty keys for doors that do or do not exist anymore, reclaiming their right to return, and continue to talk about this Nakba every month of May. Israelis celebrating what they call their independence. I don't know independence from what or from who. And we commemorate our Nakba, and with all our pain, sympathy, and empathy to Jews and their suffering, should we pay for the crimes of the Nazis or the crimes of Europe or the crimes of anti-Semitism anywhere in the world? Should we accept to repair an injustice by another injustice? And should we just think that it's a religious war and not really an occupied and an occupier war and a colonial war? Should we accept to be marginalized and kicked out and say, well, a land without a people for a people without a land? Well, the surprise is that this pride was already married, as some of the Jewish discoverers said, and that there was people and there was a culture and there were a great culture, and even the most famous singers in Egypt, when they want to go and test a new song before going to tour in the Arab world, they were coming to Yaffa, to the Palestinian population, because they were critical and has a beautiful taste in arts. And the first people who made cinema in Egypt were Palestinians, brothers Lama. And one of the first women photographers was a Palestinian woman. The Palestinian Women Union was created in 1921. In 1929, this Palestinian Women Union made one of the biggest demonstrations against the British mandate, honking, having 120 cars united 120 cars in a demonstration in the streets of Jerusalem in 1929. And you can imagine how easy it is to get 120 cars in 1929, and by women honking their horns all over the way. And in 1882, one of the first demonstrations against the first Zionist colony, which was established by European Jews who came with this Zionist idea to establishing a homeland for Jews in Palestine. So this was even before Gandhi and before Martin Luther King, this history of nonviolent resistance in Palestine. Mm-hmm. In 1936, there was this big strike for 6 months, which paralyzed all Palestine and the British and so on. And they have given the White Book, as they call it, to stop the Jewish immigration and try to please Palestinians and Arabs and so on. And all over this history, putting Palestine under a British mandate, British promising a homeland for Jews in Palestine in 1917 with Balfour Declaration promised to the Rothschilds, and hiding, like permitting immigration, stopping immigration, permitting Jewish immigration, stopping Jewish immigration, and so on. All of this was going on in different ways until finally the British left us together to fight with each other without solving any issue. Palestine was never a land without a people. Mm-hmm. And Palestinians have lived in that country, Muslim, Christian, Jews, others, as people who belong to that country. And with all respect of different people, and I understand the Jewish vision of considering themselves as people, not as religion only. What is a European Jew or an American Jew has to do with a Palestinian Jew as native of that country? We have Muslim Americans, Christian Americans, Jewish Americans, Hindu Americans, whatever Americans, we have Palestinian Jews, Christian Jews, Muslim Jews, Muslim Palestinians, Christian Palestinians, Jewish Palestinians, and others. We have Jewish Egyptians, Muslim Egyptians, Christian Egyptians, and others. So you define yourself by the country you are born in, not by, or sometimes also the heritage that they have, but you are either American or Palestinian or French or whatever. And if I am going to Spain after these years and saying, well, Muslims have ruled in Spain for 800 years, so this is my ancestry, and if all Christians come to Palestine and say, well, Jesus was born here, so move everybody else, or Muslims come to Palestine and say, Muhammad went to the skies from here, so it's ours now, and so on. It's sometimes difficult for us, and with all, again, trying to understand this complex of Jews for their suffering and the Holocaust and this anti-Semitism against them all over history until today, the trying to have this safety space, what they call it, Israel, and some of them who close their eyes against all the atrocities that Israel is doing in the name of Judaism and in the name of the Holocaust and in the name of this suffering of their people, we cannot accept it. And I guess we are fortunate in having Jews raising their voices and saying that we cannot accept it, not in our name as well. And it's important that these Jewish voices say it highly, because it's important that when our children come and see Jews who are different from these soldiers who are behind our doors, these Jews who are raising their voices and say, we are not condoning what Israel is doing in our name and we cannot accept it, it's important they will not say the Jews are this and the Jews are that, but the Israeli, the Zionists are this and the Zionists are that. And those Israelis who stand also against the policies of their government and pay it sometimes highly, by imprisonment and by being alienated and by being considered as self-hating Jews and anti-Semitic Jews even, it is important that these voices resist this normalization of the occupation and denial of the existence of the other, and saying that, well, we are Arabs, so we should go to one of the 22 Arab countries, make another tragedy in another Arab country. Well, we cannot do that. And that's something that you don't need to be learned somehow, because no victim of rape can get used to rape. No victim of oppression can get used to oppression. No victim of hatred can just get used of hatred and say, I'm fine with it. And despite all what my parents lived, I never heard them speaking badly about anyone, about anybody. My father has fear, but he never said, these Jews are doing this and that, or we should hate them. And in fact, he never tolerated we speak badly about anyone. And if we dare to speak badly about anyone, he would just say, shut up. He or she is better than you, even if it was the worst person in the world for me. And if it was an adult speaking, he would say, just, could you please change the subject or leave? So we were not raised in hatred. I never had hatred in my heart. I had sometimes a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. And that's why, I guess, trying to canalize it in the most beautiful, constructive way, like theater, arts, and with this creation of beautiful resistance, a way to just help build the peace within before talking about the peace with the others, telling my story as I want to tell it, as I live it, not to be hypocrite or complicit and try to please others and say, yeah, we can. We cannot, if with the injustice, just keep it going on. And my parents were not Harvard graduates, but with this little education they had, they always told us that even with a just cause, if you practice violence, you lose part of your humanity. So it's always this thing that you are someone who is important, who can make a change, and you should not hide within your fear or hatred, if we can say that, to justify all the things that you are doing. And you can do things without need to carry a gun and shoot everybody else. And when you look at Palestinian history, more than 95% of Palestinian people never carried a gun in their life. And they resisted with all this beauty, humanity, culture, and existence on this land, attachment to their history, their heritage, and their embroidery, and their folklore, and their hummus, and falafel, and so on. And staying just, we do not, as Rosa Parks said, want to make history. But we never just give up. We cannot give up. And we cannot get used to it.
That was Abdel Fattah Abu Sroor, director and founder of the Al Rawad Theater Training and Cultural Society in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, telling his family's Nakba story, the story of the loss of their home and land when Jewish military forces drove them into exile in 1948 to create the State of Israel. It is important that these stories continue to be told, lest we lose sight of the enormous injustice perpetrated by the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And it is important for us who support the struggle of Palestinians to gain meaningful statehood and control of their land, to stand with them in their nonviolent cultural resistance to occupation. The popular narrative pressed by Israel characterizes the Palestinians as terrorists, yet they have a long, proud history of nonviolent resistance. That history is well documented by Mazen Kunsia in his latest book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, published by Pluto Press. It is a painful book to read because so much of the nonviolent struggle has been and continues to be met with brutal military retaliation by Israel against an unarmed people as the international community stands by. But we can help. We can be a part of this nonviolent resistance by supporting organizations such as Al-Rawad, but also by supporting the call by Palestinians to boycott Israeli products, especially those produced in the illegal Israeli settlements such as SodaStream and Ahava Beauty products. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign is a call by Palestinians to stand with them in their nonviolent struggle to end the occupation, to challenge the Israeli apartheid state and the continuing theft of their land. You want to do something? Do this. Google boycott Israeli products or words to that effect, and you will gain access to numerous websites that will educate you and hopefully involve you in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. If you care at all about bringing a nonviolent solution to the Palestinian struggle to gain justice in their homeland, please find a way to boycott Israeli products. Stand up, educate yourselves, and act. Well, that's all the time we have this morning. Thank you for tuning into This Week in Palestine, a segment of Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.